This is episode 4B of Free As in Freedom. I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
This is Free As in Freedom.
We have a very special episode.
Oh my gosh, it's so exciting. Part two, really.
Yeah, so in the last episode, you heard basically mostly me rant about CLAs and Karen
say sorry about that.
Few comments. Well, she egged me on, so there was that. But now we have, and I made reference in that previous show that we were trying to get guests on to talk about this, and they weren't responding. Well, we got them together. We
and
got
the
response,
are.
And here they are, two guests to talk about the issue of CLA, specifically discuss the issues with OpenStack and its CLA,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's going to be a discussion that you'll all very much enjoy. So here it is. So Karen, our listeners have enjoyed the hot topic of contributor licensing agreements and copyright assignment agreements, and we are honored to have basically a panel discussion here on our show, which we don't do often. And I first want to start off by thanking our two guests for dealing with the audio stuff that's going on and getting it all working. And I want to introduce our guest. We have Van Limburg, who is at Rackspace and is well known as a lawyer in open source and free software. He wrote a book once upon a time about it. And Richard Fontana from Red Hat, whom our listeners know a little bit better, who is also a former patent attorney and now is a open source and free software licensing person. So do you guys, did I get those intros right? Or is there anything else each of you want to say about your role?
I'm still a registered patent attorney.
I also am still a registered attorney, although I recently moved over to the business side, so I could do a little bit more code.
So let's start there. Can you tell us, Van, from your view, sort of what the give us the combined case for CLAs? Because I know you support them. What's the business and legal case together? How do those mesh to make a case for CLAs?
All right, that's a. I'm going to have to start by answering a little bit like a lawyer, saying to a certain extent it depends. I think that you use different structures to achieve different results. But let me talk in general about what I think some of the advantages are. The first is that there are enough companies out there that worry about contributing to free software, worry about IP loss, etc., that I think that one of the main functions of a CLA is to force some sort of involvement by the legal department of the contributor's employer. Now, on occasion, this results in, hey, you can't do that, and I think that that's a real shame, because I think that most of the time people's worries are overblown. But I would rather have that answer come up ahead of time than beforehand. The second major advantage that I see from CLAs is that they allow you to provide some protection for the project overall that will help both developers and especially end users farther down the line. Now, this has usually been couched in terms of copyrights, i.e., hey, so-and-so contributed something, they didn't have the ability to contribute a code, you need to yank it. I do think that that's an issue. I think that that is less of an issue because I've only even heard of that coming up a handful of times. My concerns around the ability of people to later enforce legal rights against a free software project largely center around patent rights these days, because those are not typically Those are not typically covered in most free and open source software licenses. And while you have some implied rights, I think that implied rights are definitely, if you could get explicit rights, those are definitely preferable to implied rights. And I also think that there are some scoping issues in terms of how broad, even for those licenses that include a patent grant, how broad that patent grant can be with reference to very complicated multi-module types of projects, specifically like OpenStack, where this is being talked about quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. So I want to get into that detail in a couple of minutes, because I think our listeners will be really excited to hear more about that detail. But before I do, Fontana, I want you to kind of respond to that, because you've been a proponent of this idea of an inbound equals outbound approach, similar to what the DCO uses. You have a nuanced view about it, I know, but can you talk about the issue of how do the free software licenses we already use take care of this? Do we really need a CLA to address all the things that Van is raising?
Well, I can imagine a CLA that would address some of the things that, or issues that Van is raising. I don't think that the CLAs that are in common use today and that are actually commercially acceptable to the participants in these projects really achieve the kinds of things that Van is talking about. I'm really very skeptical about that. If they were more powerful instruments, I might, and if I thought that the risk was as great as Van, I think, sees the risk, I might, you know, alter my views. But I see the risks as being fairly low based on current experience, not just on the copyright side, but on the patent side. So I'm not saying that software is not vulnerable to patent risk. Obviously it is. But the ability of an ordinary CLA to capture that and minimize that risk through the capturing of a contribution to the project from an actor that later on, you know, does something that might be considered bad, is, you know, it's very small. So I'm very skeptical about the ability of common CLAs to do anything about this. And the kinds of CLAs I can imagine that could be more effective in addressing this problem are ones that no companies participating in these kinds of projects want to sign. And there's a reason why, you know, OpenStack CLAs are modeled on the Apache license, the Apache Foundation CLAs. They don't really do all that much, in this regard. Now, as to your question about, whether the free software licenses are good enough, I mean, my view is that in general, they are relative to the common types of CLAs that are in use. Again, the CLAs that are used don't really do much that's different from what these licenses do. The Apache CLA model has a patent license grant in it, a copyright license grant. It doesn't really do a whole lot more, or it's hard for me to see the argument that it does a whole lot more than the Apache license. And it also casts doubt on why the project is using a supposedly narrower license when it releases its software. It should be using the CLA actually as the license of the project if the CLA is so much better.
Van, do you want to respond to that? Are you using an uncommon CLA? Or is that what you're advocating for?
Well, first of all, with regards to the larger point of could these CLAs be better, and are we trapped somewhat by magic words or already accepted words? Yes, I fully agree with that. But I'd like to sort of respond in two ways. Number one, I didn't hear a response to the first point of, hey, I would like to get the legal department involved earlier as opposed to later. I maintain that that's a significant benefit, and that's something that we should preserve. Now, there's a little bit of a nuance here in that I think that a lot of times for unaffiliated developers or for developers who have been given the freedom to contribute as they will by their employer, I think that a DCO or an inbound outbound, I tend to be pretty much okay with that. It is only in the case where you have large corporate contributions or places where you have multiple comp- possible competing claims, that I tend to want to get that legal department involvement earlier.
Yeah, and so my question about that though is whether the legal department should already be involved. I mean, I realize that I'm somewhat of an idealist, but it seems to me that the it's pretty heavy weight to use a CLA. Basically, it sounds like almost, Van, you're talking about using it as a triggering mechanism to get the attention of the legal department. That seems more an education issue than a documentation issue. Yeah, if people were triggered to know that they need to pay attention to things like the DCO or other types of mechanisms we have for assent, because I think we're probably all in agreement about the question of making sure that the assent of the person who holds the copyright was there for the license that is in use. I mean, that I think we could probably be in universal agreement about. And I agree that maybe that needs to trigger legal department interest. But why, Van, do you think, and I know, Fontana, you want to make a point, but I want to drill on this. Van, why do you think that's the only way to trigger the legal department's attention?
Because this is a little bit of being a realist in terms of a lot of times people, a legal agreement will trigger to the developer that they need to trigger legal review, where something like the DCO does not trigger that or does not typically cause that same behavior. Is this an education issue? Sure, it could be addressed that way over time. But right now, what is the more likely route to getting proper review and assent? I think it's a CLA.
So Fontana, so what's your response to that?
Yeah, I understand this argument, and I know I didn't respond to it before. So first of all, I mean, it's a little odd because, you know, for a long time, going back several years ago, around the time that I started Red Hat, left SFLC, there was this period when I think a lot of companies were very conscious of you know, their employees getting involved in open source projects and setting up all sorts of really kind of, in some ways, ridiculously heavyweight rules around that. And maybe some of the rules were not so ridiculous. But I think that I don't really see much evidence that there's much of a difference there. I think that companies, you know, ought to be aware that their employees acting in the scope of their employment are contributing to, you know, free software projects and under particular licenses, and they need to be aware of what that means. And I don't think that you need to have to use a CLA for that to happen. This isn't the normal way that I would expect it to happen. I mean, maybe I'm just sort of seeing this too much from a Red Hat point of view. But, you know, I mean, we know what projects developers are contributing to, and we're comfortable with the fact that they're, you know, committing Red Hat, or in some cases, it might be themselves, to those licenses. And we don't need the extra, you know, the extra trigger of a formal legal agreement to somehow cause us to contemplate what we wouldn't already be contemplating. We're quite aware that, you know, the implications of contributing to a GPL v3 project or GPL v2 project or an Apache license project. And I think, I mean, the sense I get is that most companies now have that same consciousness as well. There's a lot of, you know, in a way, there's this culture of risk aversion around open source and around getting your employees involved in open source projects. And so that already exists even when there are no CLAs. So I don't really see much evidence for there being a need for you know, sort of waking up the legal department when they already wouldn't be woken up. And the other thing is that these agreements aren't, you know, when we talk about this, you know, when this has been talked about in the OpenStack context, it's talked about in an idealized way. And the reality is, you know, sometimes these agreements are they're not signed by the legal department. They're signed by, you know, some business person, or we don't even really know if they're always reviewed by the legal department. We have no greater assurance that they're going to be reviewed by the legal department of a company than the mere fact of contributing to a project is going to be reviewed by the legal department of a company. We assume that's so because we have an idealized view of the whole process that goes on at these companies. But the reality that I know from experience is that it doesn't always work that way. So we're not necessarily getting as much of that benefit as we might think.
So let me respond to that. I think that you are speaking from a Red Hat perspective. And when I was in private practice, I would regularly get what I call red phone calls, where they say, we just realized that we're built on free software and we're shipping next week. What do we do? And the world is falling in. And a substantial part of the practice was going in, calming people down, and helping them see that the world was not coming to an end, but then helping them understand how they could be in compliance and still make their businesses go. I think that amongst the group that we run in, and probably amongst the group that that is going to be listening to this podcast, well, probably there is this understanding, but I would strongly disagree that it is widely known. And then you talked about this culture of risk aversion to open source. I think there's a culture of risk aversion in legal in general that is not always necessarily healthy, but we need to deal with it. You say we can't be sure that there is that legal is actually being triggered, but I think that while that is in general true, I think that it is more likely that you get the sort of review that you would like through going through a CLA procedure. And even if it is some sort of executive that signs it, that means that there was at least the effort to get somebody who had more apparent authority, either actual or apparent authority, to review and assent to the contribution. So I think that the fundamental disagreement is in the state of the world outside of free software contributing companies. I think that most people and most legal departments still see free software as somewhat scary and sort of a black box. Now, the world is changing and they're being dragged into the future, or into the present, I should even say, but this is about what is calculated to bring about the best result in the widest majority of cases.
So my feeling, I have this, you say Red Hat, Fontana's looking from a Red Hat perspective. I'm looking at purely from an individual community developer perspective. And my concern is I don't see the trade-off value. The level to which extra work is put onto developers specifically to deal with CLAs, and I know we've been talking about OpenStack as an example, that developers who have worked on OpenStack, who work for the OpenStack Foundation, have been constantly complaining that they're left with this complex task of collecting both the individual and corporate CLAs, and they aren't able to do it well, and they've had to write software to help them do it well. And so all this extra work that our community is forced to do, the individual developers are forced to do, because somebody said, well, it'll be easier to get new corporate contributors to be able to willing to put their code upstream if we do this. But I'm wondering who's doing the analysis of the cost benefit analysis between those two things, of all this extra work we create for the individual developer for the sake of making a few warm fuzzies for corporate legal and corporate managers.
And just to back up, Van, I wasn't sure from what you said about the when you were making that point, whether that meant that you were only supporting CLAs for companies and not individual contributor CLAs. So if you want to clarify that in the context of Bradley's question too.
And that's a key issue for OpenStack, I should point out, because OpenStack requires currently that all individuals who want to get a patch into OpenStack have to have signed an iCLA. So that's the individual CLA modeled on the Apache Foundation's iCLA. It is really meant to bind the individual. It sort of assumes, although I think many people have overlooked this, it assumes the possibility that the company may own IP that's being licensed. But that's really the big hurdle that individual developers in getting involved in OpenStack initially face, or one of the hurdles. This ICLA requirement, which really doesn't have anything to do with this point that Van's made, which I think has some legitimacy, despite the fact that I was disagreeing with some of it, which is that, you know, yeah, you get, if you have something that has to be signed by an executive or a lawyer at a company, they're going to kind of think about things more. That doesn't apply to the case that the individuals contributing to OpenStack, especially for the first time, are dealing with, which is, you know, one of the first things they have to do is sign this individual CLA, this legalese that they may not be comfortable with or familiar with. that doesn't really affect, that's not intended to affect their, you know, what their possible employer is doing at all.
Okay, my position softens considerably in the case of individual contributors. I think that I think that there needs to be some ceremony in place. It could be a checkbox, or it could be an announcement that by affirmatively adding your code to this, you are granting a license under such and such license. I think that there are lots of easy ways to do it. Individuals are not generally the ones I'm worried about. I'm worried about essentially CCLAs, not ICLAs. I do think that there needs to be a minimum of ceremony, because otherwise you get this situation where code is put out there without any apparent licensing, and I think that that is a different problem that I'd like to avoid, but that's a separate problem. That's not necessarily a CLA issue.
Yeah, so it sounds like we actually sort of agree on the ICLA part of this. Right.
So with the CCLA, and just for our listeners, I want to clarify, the ICLA is an individual contributor license agreement, one that an individual person would sign, and the CCLA is a corporate contributor license agreement, the one the company would sign. So let's set aside, we've sort of come to consensus that the ICLA is not really what's the most important thing, at the very least, and maybe not necessary at all. So let's talk about this corporate CLA. Why can't, Van, that corporate CLA say very simply, you agree as a company that any copyrights you hold are being licensed under the license of the project? Why can't the CLA be that simple, one sentence?
I think that for a number of projects, that would probably be sufficient. I would, the main problem here, I think, goes back to my second point around patents. And here I'd like to basically talk about two things. Number one is the risk profile of the project and the profile of the contributors. And the importance of patent rights. So number one, different projects I think have very different risk profiles in terms of patents. For example, I think that the Linux kernel, while not necessarily completely out of the woods, it's an old project. It came about what, 1991, if I remember correctly. And it was itself based upon much older designs and concepts. Now, there have been a number of innovations in Linux, but by and large, the kernel is aged out of lots of patent threats. What's more, a lot of the Unix-y stuff that we deal with has also aged out of patent threats. Where you're dealing with something like OpenStack, where it is arguably more a younger technology. Now, I say arguably, I understand about grid computing and all this stuff, but I would say that it is solidly within the last 20 years that a lot of the final pieces that were put into place to allow what we consider cloud computing, it is much more open to patent assertions, particularly from from privateers and operating companies and things like that. So I think that there's a very different risk profile associated with something like OpenStack than something like the Linux kernel. Number two is the profile of who's contributing. If you've got something that's mostly individual contributors, I think that this becomes a much smaller issue. If you've got something where the vast majority of contributors are doing so because of their employment, then I think that getting the patent licenses from the contributors are more important. And number three, I talked about the scope issue. Now, I think this is easiest to understand in the specific instance of OpenStack. And I understand people can disagree with me here, but I see the patent license that is included within the, let's say that someone puts in their code under the Apache license, which includes a patent license. That patent license is with reference to the larger work work with which this particular contribution is integrated. I tend where you have something that is where you have a project that is sort of an umbrella project and in itself includes lots of sub-projects that I think are individual copyrighted works, I don't see that patent grant as applying to other sub-modules or other sub-projects that fall within that umbrella. So it's possible to grant licenses to one sub-project and still reserve the ability to, under the Apache license, still reserve the ability to make assertions against other sub-projects under the same umbrella. I want to prevent the possibility of doing this, and I only see a CLA at the corporate level as the way to do that.
So, yeah, I'm actually Fontaine, I have a point I want to throw in there that I actually think that's that the last thing you said in particular is a noble goal, in the sense that your goal is to get these companies to assure the project they're not going to assert their patents against the project, even when the patents are maybe beyond the scope of their contribution. And it's certainly true that the free software licenses we generally deal with only cover a direct patent license for the contribution. That certainly the Apache license works that way, and many of the others do as well. Now I have 2 points, and then I'm going to hand it over to Fontana. One is, I'm surprised the companies are willing to give that broad of a patent license in the first place. And second, I'm recalling, and this is where Fontana can really pick it up, that during GPL v3, the desire for a really broad patent license was watered down over the v3 process, specifically because companies didn't want it and they lobbied against it for their own reasons. So Fontana, how does that play out?
So the history there was that there were companies that were saying we want something more like the Apache license. And they probably meant at the time, this was 2006, 2007. They were probably thinking, at the time the Apache license was more popular in the Apache Software Foundation ecosystem. So they were certainly familiar with the Apache license used in conjunction with these kinds of CLAs. So they thought of the Apache model as a weak patent licensing model. That's why they liked it. And that's actually why I think the Apache license became a very popular open source license. And one of the reasons why GPL v3 didn't is that GPL v3 was perceived, possibly incorrectly, was perceived as having a much broader scope of, sort of patent licensing commitments than the Apache license. So there was a lot of corporate resistance to what the Free Software Foundation was trying to do in GPL v3. And the Apache license and the EPL were being held up as better models because they were weaker. And so this model that OpenStack uses is the legacy is of weak patent licensing. Now, the issue of the scope of the patent license grant, I think there are ways of addressing that. I think there's a problem with this point, because it suggests to me the question, why is OpenStack then using the Apache license as the outbound license? Because you're kind of implying that some of the patent licenses that you're getting from the CLAs aren't then flowing down to the users. So the OpenStack Foundation is giving a less of a license, less patent licenses than, are flowing through the CLAs and now the CLAs do talk about recipients, but there's no transparency in like what patent licenses you're getting in a given situation. So all you know as a user of OpenStack is you're getting an Apache license grant from the Apache Foundation. It references contributors. So if the Apache license is thought to have a narrower scope than those CLAs, that suggests that there's something wrong with the choice of the Apache license. And that maybe the patent license grant and the Apache license, which for years I've been hearing from all sides, from the Free Software Foundation, from the OSI, the Apache license was lauded as the best permissive license. Actually, Bradley, you and Karen, I think, have mentioned this on this podcast, that if you're going to use a permissive license, use the Apache license because of that patent license grant. The implication of what I think Van is saying is that the patent license grant and the Apache license is not worth as much as the patent license grants coming from the CLAs. And I don't quite understand that, because that means that there's something you're you're not getting from the OpenStack Foundation that you're getting in some way that's less clear to me from the CLAs. Now,
okay.
Okay, you can respond to it.
So I think that these, your point one and your point two, I think are actually very closely tied about this legacy of a weak patent license and the interaction of, doesn't this say that something's wrong with the Apache license? I think the core issue to understand here is the difference between mandatory broad patent licensing and permissive broad patent licensing. For example, there are many times when corporations are willing to say, within this scope that I control, I am willing to forego patent rights. This is something that happens all the time, either between companies as an individual patent license, as part of some consortia, as part of standards processes, and yes, as part of open source foundations or shared and shared projects. That doesn't necessarily mean that they want to give up patent rights in all contexts. And so the ability to match individual weaker rights with targeted broader grants is the power that the CLA plus the Apache gives you.
But Van, the only one who's benefiting from that, it seems to me, is the OpenStack Foundation, not the downstream from the OpenStack Foundation. That's sort of how I read Fontana's point, and I don't think you've really answered that. How do the users benefit from that broad CLA patent right?
So here, there are two ways in which the users benefit from it. Number one, they benefit from it because the CLA says, both to the foundation and to each person that receives the software distributed by the foundation, you grant a patent grant. So I'd like to address those. First, through the foundation, if I license one person in the chain, then distributions of the software from that licensed person exhaust the patent rights. And so the way in which I analyze it, the patent rights are exhausted with regard to the entire downstream chain. That is the protection for users number one. The protection for users number two is the portion in the CLA that says, and to anyone that receives software provided by the foundation, I also agree to grant this direct patent grant, which by virtue of it flowing through the CLA process instead of the direct contributor process, has the effect of covering the software distributed by the foundation as a whole instead of only this particular piece to which I may or may not be a contributor.
So I believe you, but so that really frightens me.
Wait, even if that's true, the patent license grants in these CLAs are, one of the reasons why they're narrow is that they're triggered or scoped in some sense by contributions. So this isn't like, you know, all the companies participating in OpenStack are saying, if we have any patents on like infrastructure as a service, you know, software, we are licensing those patents to the foundation and downstream recipients. That's not what they're saying. They're saying, if we contribute some code that in combination with OpenStack or some portion of OpenStack, and that's maybe where there's a disagreement over this scope issue, but it has to be some contribution of code, even if it's small. That has to, you know, there's language of necessary infringement, necessarily infringed in these patent license grants in the CLAs. You need that in order for the patent licensing to occur at all. And so I don't think that this is part of why I say it's sort of almost weak by design, because you could very well have a company that has patents relevant to OpenStack technology, arguably, but it's not going to be licensing them because its contributions are not, you know, causing that necessary infringement of its patents, because the patent license grant is triggered by the contribution. You can imagine a different kind of CLA that was broader, or a different kind of system. I haven't mentioned OIN, which Red Hat strongly supports, and I think Bradley's critical of, but you know, there that's an example of an external kind of attempt to solve this issue that Van is raising. But I just don't think that these kinds of CLAs or the Apache license can do a whole lot about this issue. They can do a little bit. But I don't think, I think the Apache license does pretty much what the CLAs do anyway. That's why I believe in this, that this inbound outbound approach is good enough, because I think the difference in what's being licensed, and if you bear in mind the low likelihood of, you know, of all the patent risks to a project like OpenStack, the likelihood that that patent risk is going to come from a participant in OpenStack today, a company participating today, maybe later on it sells its patents to a troll or something. But the likelihood that it comes from one of those companies today, and then that patent claim gets triggered by a contribution, is just for me, it's common sense that that's very small. And that comes from my experience in patent prosecution, which was sort of the low point of my career, as I've told Bradley at least. But it really had a big effect on my view of and skepticism about the ability of these kinds of, you know, licenses, whether it's CLAs or open source licenses, to do a whole lot about patent risk. You really need, I think, some kinds of external mechanisms. And actually, I think, Van, you might agree with that. Maybe that's sort of politically impossible in some cases for some projects to achieve that. But I think that what you can do above and beyond the Apache license with something like a CCLA is very, very small. And that's why you have to start looking at the costs of the CLA system. We haven't talked too much about the costs, but I think there are some costs in terms of discouraging new contributors to the project. And if you view the risk that you're containing as small, as I do, those costs start to look bigger.
So tell us, Richard, what do you see as the costs, Richard? Why don't you list off the costs?
So we've been hearing anecdotal evidence over the past year or so of new contributors trying to get involved in OpenStack, and there's just too many hurdles they have to go through to get their first patch in. It's not just the CLA process, but the CLA process is part of it, and it's in a sense what some of the developers in the technical community have seized upon as a big roadblock. There are other roadblocks as well. For example, currently you have to join the OpenStack Foundation in order to get a patch in, as you have to join as an individual member. But you also have to sign the ICLA, and you know, in principle, you're supposed to do something to get your employer to sign the CCLA, although it's not clear how much that part is enforced. So the cost is that you're creating barriers for new contributions. The existing contributors don't face these barriers. So if you're employed by, Red Hat or IBM or Rackspace or any of the existing vendors participating heavily in OpenStack, you know, it's not such a big deal. I actually know some developers at Red Hat and actually at other companies as well who refuse to sign the ICLA on principle, or at least in the past refuse to do so. But basically the obstacles are for the new contributors. And that's important for OpenStack, because OpenStack has to continue to attract new contributors to be a successful project. It can't just rely on vendors trying to employ these contributors. They're not widgets. They're not commodities. These are highly skilled developers. One category is the highly skilled developer, which is in short supply. You really need to get these skilled Python developers who know a lot about cloud computing, distributed computing. If you make it too hard for them to get involved in the project as individuals, they're not going to want to participate. They're going to, you know, go to some other project or do something else. And the other category is that OpenStack has realized that it needs to get a lot more feedback from users of OpenStack, from operators of OpenStack, people who are trying to run OpenStack clouds. And these are people typically, you know, new contributors or would-be contributors. They don't, you know, their patches are very small. But they're the ones also who are facing these roadblocks in trying to contribute to the project. So the project is deterring the very kinds of contributors that it needs to in order to continue to grow and succeed on a technical basis.
So I think that there is a I think that there are some different points of agreement, and there are some definite points of disagreement. The first is with regard to the fact that these have a cost, and that we need and we want more OpenStack developers, and we want to reduce the barriers for contribution, I couldn't agree more. I am fully in support of everything that Richard just said. I'd like to point out just one little thing, though. The first is, in all of these cases, for the licenses, for the CLAs, you have to go back to the text. And in particular, the corporate CLA in numeral 3 says, subject to the terms and conditions of this agreement, you hereby grant to the project manager and to recipients of software distributed by the project manager a perpetual blah, 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 blah patent license.
Patent license to what, though, Van? That's the question. Is the place where I hear you guys disagreeing about scope is, does it Fontana's saying it's a combination of their contribution with the larger OpenStack, and you're saying it's anything that reads on all of OpenStack.
Yeah, it can't be anything. That's not how the CLAs are drafted, and it's not how the Apache license is drafted either. That's, again, why it was touted during GPLv3 long ago as such a better model, because the companies involved that were sort of lobbying in the drafting of GPLv3, they were concerned, they believed naively that GPLv3 was going to sort of take over the world of open source. And so they were worried that they were going to suddenly have like really broad patent licensing commitments. So they were putting forward the Apache license and, you know, the Eclipse public license as well as examples of sort of better drafted licenses in terms of, not better drafted, but sort of from a policy basis, better licenses, because they didn't require as much of a commitment of patent licensing. And it wasn't entirely unreasonable. There were concerns about predictability, you know, wanting to be able to know what portion of your portfolio was actually being licensed. I mean, that actually makes some sense from a patent holder's point of view. So again, these are not very broad patent license grants. If we want to have broader patent license grants, we have to talk about maybe revising either CLAs or the Apache license itself, or maybe, you know, thinking about a new kind of open source license, because these licenses were not drafted to do the things that, you know, as Bradley said, sort of the noble goals that I think Van has talked about. You need either different licenses, different drafted licenses, maybe revisions to existing licenses, or external arrangements. And maybe that's what I was saying before, is maybe the more realistic way of addressing this problem, and not all companies are going to be interested in this, is to address this in a way that's sort of external to the licensing mechanisms. You know, whether it's through organizations like OIN or, you know, similar arrangements.
And so I think that in general, yes, I do strongly support additional licensing arrangements. I think that a lot of times it's difficult and politically unpalatable to draft new licenses. I think that there needs to be a substantial perceived shortfall in existing licenses in order to drive that. So I think that the easier way to get that done is through some sort of external coordination mechanism, be it the OIN or be it a CCLA administered through a foundation. As to whether the particular OpenStack CCLA does everything that I'd like, nope, it doesn't. I think that because of some of the nuances in the words, it's more likely to apply to the broader scope, but I can also see the argument that it has exactly the same scope as the Apache license. And so I have been and continue to be in support of a little bit broader mandatory patent contributions within the scope of something like OpenStack. One other point that I think was interesting is Richard said, I perceive the risk is low, particularly for people who are parts of the community. I can't really divulge any details, but I can say that we are currently dealing with patent issues, let's just say, from people who are broadly in the OpenStack community, where there's both people who are taking advantage of the software and seeking to assert patent claims on the software. So I do not at all see, at least in this specific case, that the risk is low.
But
I think
Van, the point I made is that it is, I hear that you're seeing that risk, and I can believe it. But how much of that risk would the CCLA really affect? You talked, I think, about companies using OpenStack code. This is not a copyleft license, you know. So if they're not contributing to OpenStack, they're just using OpenStack code. They're not granting patent licenses.
Would this solve my particular problem? No, I don't think it would. It would be a step toward preventing some problems. Something where suggested expansion, which I've suggested a couple times and continue to push for, of having people who are declared members of the OpenStack Foundation be required to grant a patent license to the OpenStack projects in general. I think that would go a lot farther. So none of these things are silver bullets. I'm trying to incrementally get to the place where we can really cooperate instead of reserving the ability to assert patent claims in the future.
I think we could probably talk about this all day. And in fact, we might want to consider having a follow-up conversation later as things develop. But I want to thank you both for joining us and for having this discussion. I think our listeners will really enjoy it.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, there's always an open invitation for both of you. Anytime either of you would like to come on and talk about anything that's on your mind on our Ogcast, you're always welcome.
That conflicts with some things you've said in the past, Bradley, as far as an open invitation.
Well, I hereby supersede all previous statements and say that, Richard, anytime you want to be on the Ogcast, you can be on it.
Well, thank you.
I mean, we won't clear topics with you, but if you want to respond to something, you're always welcome.
And I just want to say it's really a privilege to sort of debate with Van, because he's really one of the lawyers in, as you guys might say, in this space, who I really respect the most, and who I think is so highly knowledgeable.
Thank you, Richard, and likewise. And also, I appreciate the comments from Karen and Bradley, who also have added a lot to the discussion around these issues.
Okay, so we should, before we turn this into a mutual appreciation society, we should wrap it up. Thank you both. Our listeners are going to love this, and we'll have you on again soon.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye. Van and Fontana are both so great.
Yeah, and I like them because they're like me. They're both very long-winded, which it makes me feel better, because like I feel like I talk too much, but they like to talk too. So we're kindred spirits.
Yeah, I was going to say actually that there wasn't that much opportunity for me to talk too much. So it was quiet in the last CLA one. I was quiet in this one too, but there were so many good points mentioned.
Yeah, and I like the ongoing debate. I mean, I think the most interesting thing that came out of that is I was glad we were able to drill down on what the fundamental disagreement is. I think the fundamental disagreement is actually not the thing that bothers me most, which is sort of the non-inbound equals outbound, not relying on the license, but the scope of what patent license you can get in a CLA.
Yeah.
And I think Fontana's right. I think the scope is relatively limited. And if we really believe the scope has to be increased so much, we better rewrite these licenses to increase the scope. And if companies, heck, are willing to agree to it. And the first draft of GPL had a huge, big patent license in it that got watered down over the GPL v3 process because companies came in and said they wouldn't accept it and they wouldn't contribute if it was this, or wouldn't use it,
yeah,
wouldn't redistribute. So if we can get that, then great, we should get that. I think it's interesting that Fontana brought up OIN and HP withdrew from OIN, and HP is a big participant in OpenStack. So what's this all about? Like, what's HP hiding? And the thing is that I would be surprised if HP had Van's interpretation of the corporate CLA.
Yeah.
It can't be true because HP would probably not sign.
Maybe we should have an HP guest on there.
We should maybe do that and ask them. But we'll see. Well, I mean, this is an ongoing debate. And in fact, by the time this gets into your feed, there may be new news. So we may actually end up updating with even more news on the CLA thing. Hey, it's a big legal policy debate in the free software world. And that's what we want to cover. The only thing I want to cover is we went through a lot of hoops to get that recording working. We try to do everything with free software. Some of our backup devices are non-free, but we try to make our primary recording with free software. And so at least one person has asked about what equipment we use and stuff. So I bought a microphone a long time ago, and I ended up buying another one when we switched over to the Freeze and Freedom show. I can read it off the microphone, so I'll sound a little weird, but I do. It's the AKG C100S, which I'll link to in the show notes.
Recommended by Dan Lynch.
Recommended by Dan Lynch and Fab Chanel, who does Linux Outlaws with him. They both recommended this mic, and we have it in a converter to go XLR to the regular mini jack, 3.5 millimeter jack. And I use a external sound card. This is really important. If you record on a laptop, you should use an external sound card, not the onboard laptop sound card. This is a big thing audio people always say. And the best one I found is no longer made, so I don't know if it's worth mentioning. It's a Sennheiser one that only came with headsets, which I don't even use the headsets anymore. I just use the audio interface. But I've bought, every time I see a different USB sound card, I buy it, and it's always horrible. The ones that are in the $20 to $50 range. I think there you can get professional USB sound cards that are in the hundreds of dollars range that are really good, like $300 if you want to spend. But this is the only one that was, I think it was $40 with the headset when it first came out, was the only one that was any good. And that's our primary recording. Now, when we do guests like that, we ask each of them to record a local copy of their sound if they can. I do a backup recording using the Asterisk conference room just so we have a backup. Which I've had trouble with, but that's just my configuration problems. And then we have Dan edit the audio together. So that's basically how this show was made. So as a colophone of the show, that basically Van and Richard each recorded their own audio. We recorded our own audio using the equipment I just mentioned. And then Dan graciously edited it all together. And we handed all the extra audio off to Dan. So he may have pasted in little pieces of the backup audio from various places to make it all sound good.
Yeah, and I love that when we have shows like this where we have a discussion and have guests on, but it does create a lot more work.
Yeah, it really does. It's a lot more extra work.
So thank you, Dan.
And Dan is good to take care of that. And that creates work for our guests. I mean, guests have to do the little extra job of being on the phone. Basically, we use a phone conference room as a back channel, and then so we can hear each other, and then everybody's recording their own audio locally. So that's how we do it, since people asked.
Thanks for listening. Freeze and Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of Pod Factory and can be found at podfactory.org. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This episode of Freeze and Freedom is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. You can follow Freeze and Freedom, Bradley, and Karen on Identica, and also read Bradley's and Karen's blogs. Links can be found on the Freeze and Freedom website, faif.us. That's faif.us.
Rackspace, this blows my mind.
You didn't know Rackspace was in Texas?
I did not know Rackspace was in Texas.
Yeah.
I shouldn't mess with Texas. Yeah, apparently I messed with Texas.